Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode. This event was proudly supported by Maurice Blackburn Lawyers.
Welcome, everyone. Such a pleasure to be here with you all. And my name is Professor Anne Patel Gray, and I've been asked to moderate this session. I'd like to begin with acknowledgement of country. Welcome to the Melbourne Writers' Festival. We respectfully acknowledge that today we are gathered on the unceded lands of the Kulin Nation, and we recognise their sovereignty. We pay our respect to their elders, both past and present, and we wish to give recognition to the next generation of leaders. We'd like to welcome you all today and welcome Stan. Thank you so much for being here with us today. And the Melbourne Writers' Festival would like to extend a warm thanks to the supporters of this session, the Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. We thank you so much, and we will have them come up at the end and say a few words. We have a Q&A at the end in the last final 15 minutes of the session, and you will be encouraged to ask questions, and there will be people in the audience with microphones, so all I need you to do is put your hand up and I'll point you out. Also, there is book sales and book signing immediately following this session. Stan Grant is a proud Wiradjuri and Kamilaroi man. He began his career as a journalist in 1987. He has worked for the ABC, SBS, the Seven Network and the Sky News Australia. From 2001 to 2012, he worked for CNN as an anchor and a senior correspondent in Asia and the Middle East. As a journalist, he has received a string of prestigious international and Australian awards. In 2015, he published his best-selling book, Talking to My Country, which won the Walker Lee Book Award, and he also won a Walker Lee Award for his coverage of Indigenous affairs. In 2016, he was appointed to the Referendum Council on Indigenous Recognition. Stan is now Chair of the Indigenous Australian Belonging at Charles Sturt University and International Affairs Analyst at the ABC. Let's put our hands together to welcome Stan. Thank you.
Thank you. And do you mind if I just say something in my language?
Yep, please.
Yirudumara, Baduru Waradri Gibia, Diramadilinya, Baduru Waradri, Nadu Indumara, Waradri Mine, Gmilaroi Mine. Darawal mine. Nadi Indiamara Wurundjeri mine, Wurundjeri Noorumbung, Kulin Noorumbung. I just want to pay respect to my people, Wiradjuri, Gamilaroi, Darawal people, and bring our respect as well to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and their land. And to speak those words on the day of we prepare for the coronation of the king and the crown that sought to extinguish our rights to our own country, to speak a language that Australia sought to silence and a language that my people, Wiradjuri people, and through my father, who has fought so hard to keep our language alive today, to say that we are still here, that we still speak our language and we are still a people in our country.
And ladies and gentlemen, you wish you were sitting here where I'm sitting now. He's proper handsome, this man.
Nah.
You might get a bit of pleasure next later to shake a hand and have a conversation. But let's get serious now. I must say I read this book and it moved me in many different ways, from tears to anger to frustration to hope.
Mm.
And I highly recommend it. You will absolutely enjoy reading this. And you will not go away not feeling moved, let me tell you that much. But let me start my questions. I've got him in the vulnerable seat. I get to ask the questions today. Why the title, Stan? The Queen is Dead.
Because it was a cathartic moment, I think, for me. I felt that viscerally when the Queen died. I mean, it's a statement of fact. The Queen is dead. Mm. But it captured something. It was a punctuation point. But this Queen, for all of us in the room, is probably the only Queen that we have known in this country. It's the Queen that stared down at us from our schoolrooms and in our RSL clubs and our ex-servicemen's clubs and our hotels and our CWA halls, and such a part of who we were and what it represented. And I found in the Queen's death, in that moment of the death, a real cathartic reckoning, I suppose, with my own country and our history. I felt like the wounds of history were being reopened. That what the Queen represented, the crown, and what that had brought to our country, and the things that we still don't speak about, and the things that we have not resolved. I was confronted by this as someone who works in the media when I saw the mourning, the ritualized mourning that the nation went into. All the newsreaders, the people where I worked at the ABC, all put on black suits and white ties, and I felt estranged. I felt betrayed. I felt alone, and I couldn't do that. Not because of any disrespect to an individual. I'm raised with respect. To be Wiradjuri, to be First Nations person, is to know what respect is. But I could not participate in mourning something that represented so much pain to my own people. And out of that cathartic experience came the book. All I can do in those moments is write. Mm. It's the place that I hold for me, where I wrestle with my place in the world and who I am and what does all of this mean. And to come face to face with your history in a cathartic moment demanded that I just grapple with it. And that's what happened over an 8-week period. I woke up every morning at 4 o'clock. Between 4:30 and 7:30, I sat and I wrestled with these big questions. And I wanted to capture the moment. The Queen is dead. What now? Who are we? What does this mean? And to write it in real terms as I grappled with those things.
Stan, in the book, you describe whiteness not as a skin colour but as a mindset. Could you elaborate more on that, please?
Well, whiteness sits at the heart of this because I refer to the Queen throughout, and it was a poetic literary device, but I think also something that gave me a vantage point. I refer to her throughout as the White Queen, not Queen Elizabeth, because we know in our own culture as well that when someone has passed, we refer to them differently. The White Queen. Why the White Queen? To separate the individual from what she represented. I refer to that constantly. The White Queen is dead. It's like a poetic call and response. I wanted to return to that. Return to that refrain like an old blues song. Back to that refrain. Back into the next idea. The White Queen is dead. And she was the essence of whiteness. The reason she sits on that throne, or she sat on that throne, is because of the inheritance of whiteness, of empire, of colonization. And it's not real. It is invented. It is a fiction made real. Race is invented. And whiteness is not a color. It is an organizing principle. One of the things that I explore in the book is the development of whiteness as a notion, as a political notion. And it happened to people that we may look at and call white. It happened in the first colony in Ireland. The name that the British had, the Latin name for the Irish, the indigenous Irish, the Gaelic-speaking Irish, was Hibernicus, the Latin term for unfree. They were the unfree, the people whose land was taken, whose language was silenced, whose children were taken, whose culture was smashed. There was a racialized political hierarchy that established them as something else and the crown as the essence of whiteness and power. And we've seen that throughout the world, into India, into Africa, Australia, the places where the idea of whiteness, the divine right of kings, the doctrines of discovery, established a hierarchy of power that we still live with today. And I wanted to explore the notions of whiteness as an organizing principle and then think, how do I free myself from that?
It's interesting that the Pope recently rejected the doctrine of discovery.
Yeah.
And yet very little media was taken up about that position. I find that interesting.
Mm. Mm.
In your book, you reflect on the similarities of colonial empires, treatment of indigenous peoples across the globe, and you just mentioned very quickly a part of that. And in particular, by the time the British Empire invaded Australia, they had perfected their colonial techniques used against Aboriginal people, and you describe how they suffered greatly as a consequence. Can you reflect more on that for us?
I think we're all trapped in this logic of race, this evil of the imagination, this evil spell, as I describe it. And I talk about race and whiteness as like a maze of mirrors. You walk through the maze of mirrors and it distorts who you are. It changes the way you see yourself. We're captured in the eye of whiteness. And so is whiteness itself. So are white people themselves, trapped within this organizing principle of race. And we see that play out, of course, here devastatingly amongst our people, and where we even lose who we are in the world. Why I spoke that language today, Wiradjuri language, is because it is an expression of a language that comes from a place and connects me to a place. And yet when the British came here, we ceased to be Wurundjeri, Gamilaroi, Dharawal, Kalgadoon, whatever we may be. We ceased to be many of the hundreds of nations, and we became initially Indians, as they called us, then Aborigines, right through to the various names we use today, but not us. We were immediately cast as something else, the other. And that's that logic, and I think we're all trapped in that. And it does distort the way we see ourselves. There's a phrase that two African-American scholars use, Barbara and Karen Fields, they talk about racecraft. Racecraft is a term they invented to describe the invention of this myth of race. They said it's like witchcraft. Its power is our power to believe. Once we believe in the idea, the evil comes. They say racism, in fact, is the parent of race, not the other way around. And we are trapped in that logic. It is part of the way we connect with each other. Even with the best of intentions, we still frame ourselves in this way, with whiteness centered and the rest of us orbiting. I was watching a news story, and I reflect on this in the book, and the news story was of a gunman in the United States, another gun attack, and a dozen or so black people were killed. And the reporter, well-meaning, I'm sure, said these people were killed simply because of the colour of their skin. No, they were not. There was nothing in the colour of their skin that determined that they should die. They were killed because of someone's idea of the colour of their skin. They were killed because of the twisted, distorted evil of a person who looked at them and saw something else. We need to use the language They were killed because of man's hatred of the colour of their skin, not because of the colour of their skin. So even white people are trapped in this logic of race. We can't think ourselves free. And in Australia, to bring it back to us, look around this room. Look at the faces and the places that we all come from. We inhabit this space born out of the brutality of what happened to our people, Anne. And we still can't come to terms with this because of these things that sit between us, the things that we have inherited, the languages that we use.
Thank you. Stan, you state in your book, I'm not here to speak of politics. Mm. Politics feels cheap to me. Whenever I come close to politics, I feel diminished. Mere politics cannot ease the depth of our affliction. Politics alone cannot deliver justice. So why a voice? If the voice means that our people can live longer, healthier, if it means our children have a chance to walk in this world as who they are, then it is critical. There are things to be fought for. There are political battles to win. But the Uluru Statement from the heart is bigger than politics. It's even bigger than the voice. It is love.
Mm. I think that's the essence of what I'm trying to find in the book, is where is love in a world? It can't be love in a world that centres whiteness at the centre of the world. There can't be love in a world of race and race hatred. There can't be love in a world of injustice. The thing that I saw in the Uluru Statement from the Heart, and it is bigger than the voice, is an incredible expression of love from a people who know who they are and where they are, our people. The ability to give love to those who had no love for us. If you read it and you read of the spiritual notions of belonging and sovereignty that sit at the heart of that, that speaks to me as a Wiradjuri, Gamilaroi, Dharawal person. That's the essence of who we are. It's the love I see in the touch of my parents. It's the love of standing on my country. It's the love of diving into a river. It's the love of hearing the guru, the magpie, my father's totem, singing in the trees. Politics can't give me that. A referendum can't give me that. There are things of politics. And whether it's to seek a treaty, whether it's a voice and a treaty, truth-telling, if it's bureaucracy that spends a dollar better, then fine. But in many ways, that's for other people. One thing I've come to realise about myself is I'm not a political person. I'm a spiritual person. And I'm closer and more at peace when I'm with that spirit in land and people and with the love that comes from our people. My father always tells me, son, don't let them become what they want you to become. Never lose our yindyamara, which is our word for respect. Because if you do, you will stop being who you are. That's who we are. And I think that's the journey in the book, is to find a place of love in a place where there was no love, is to find a place of grace in the lament for everything that has happened to us, and to think myself free of those chains of history that others seek to bind me in, while never losing sight of what history has done and never losing sight of justice.
Yeah. This leads to another quote that I've taken from your book. Modernity has supplanted God with its own faith in progress and reason. The liberalism that emerged out of this 17th and 18th century enlightenment imagines that we can wash ourselves clean of the past. But there can be no redemption without atonement. The voice walks this line between justice and forgiveness. It risks becoming captured by the liberalism it seeks to speak back to. For me, the voice must speak from the right side of God. It must speak from the side of the suffering.
Yeah. There's a lot in that. And a lot that was revealed to me when I was writing the book, because I was writing the book in real time. I mean, just listening to that now, it's almost like someone else wrote it. You know, it's like a blur in some ways.
Powerful words.
Well, it's like you're out of yourself. And that's when you're truly writing, I think, is when you forget yourself. When you're not writing for someone to read, you're writing to get closer to God, to our ancestors, to our spirit. I was back on my country recently at an old mission called Warringesda. It's where my great-grandmother was born under a tree. The mission was set up at a time when we were being slaughtered. And a lot of the descendants of that mission went back to the old mission station, and a lot of the old buildings are still there. And when I stood in that place with my people under those stars on that ground, I say to people, there was not a slither of light between Bayami, our creator, between my people, between me and my country. Just a perfect alignment. And I seek to get close to that in writing. It's the place that I can be who I am and feel the connection to ancestors in a way that makes everything else around me disappear. And part of the journey for me has been to try to understand why others sought to eradicate that from the earth, to remove our people from the earth. What is this idea of modernity? What is it that sits in the mind of whiteness? What is democracy and liberalism? These things, the organizing principles of our world, that lose sight of the spirit of who we are. And I wanted to get closer to the spirit of who we are. I think the danger already, and I'm seeing this in this year of referendum, is that when we become immersed in politics, whether you're this side or that side, whether you agree, whether you disagree, we start to lose sight of the thing that actually makes us part of each other. We're not politics. Politics occupies too great a space in our lives. We are people, and we are people of a story. We are an unfolding, unending story. And I'd like to think a story of grace. I'd like to think a story of love. But I've seen so much hatred in the world, so much evil and violence in the world as a reporter, in the wars that I've reported from, to know that we are challenged every day by these things of politics that pit us against each other. And what I'm looking for there, and when I talk about the voice, it's not even the political representation of the voice. It is the essence of a story that connects us to each other. In the words of Paul Ricoeur, the great French philosopher, the shortest distance to the self is through the other. We know who we are because we know the souls of others. That's what I'm trying to get through. That's the only reason I really write.
Well, your words move me, because this quote that I now read, my prayer is that one day, with enough love in their hearts, those who sing the songs of glory of Australia will find love enough for us too. Those are moving words, Dan.
Yeah, because I never felt part of the song of Australia. I've wrestled with that idea all my life. One of the earliest memories I have of school is standing in the quadrangle at assembly and having to recite the oath. Some of you who are of my vintage may remember doing this. I honour my God, I serve my Queen, I salute the flag. I used to have to say that every day. And I remember as a 5 and 6-year-old, these are the, I think my mother used to always say to me, you know, you were born so old. And because I'd always be asking these things. And I knew that wasn't what I saw. That wasn't what we felt. That was an Australia that didn't speak to us. a national anthem, a flag that we know has been used to exclude us more often than not. And not that we haven't sought a way in. My grandfather fought in World War II. His brother, my great uncle, died in the fields of France, fighting for a country that didn't recognize who we are. When my grandfather came back from fighting World War II, he could not board a train to go home in his uniform. He could not share a drink with his mates in the pub. This is what I was asked to recite an oath of allegiance to. It never felt right because love was missing. And yet at home I was surrounded by love. The love of my grandfather, my mum's dad, who was married, or wasn't married because they couldn't marry, but who lived with and loved a white woman. She was turned away from the hospital having their first child because it was the child of an Aboriginal man. She was constantly harassed by police accused of running grog for the blacks. My grandfather, my mother, saw him arrested by the police and chained to a tree like a dog in the sun all day with no food and no water, accused of drinking alcohol. And this beautiful man who used to sit there and we'd spend the hours just with each other, lost in our own worlds, talking about stories. And the love I felt at home and the love that was missing in this place we called Australia that was never designed for us. And I think in the book and in all the things I try to write is to bring the love that was in our hearts to the love to people who didn't show the love for us so that they may love and make the idea of whatever we call this country that we are in, this place that we share together, a place that means more than just a pledge of allegiance or an anthem or a flag, the symbols, but actually connects us to a story that's much deeper than that.
You know, for Aboriginal people, the one thing that I felt reading your book is you gave words to my feelings. And quite often we struggle to find the words to articulate how we feel. I also look at, you know, where you struggle with betrayal. Quoting, "I feel betrayed. It is the worst betrayal, white betrayal. This white betrayal falls silent when someone makes a racist joke. This white betrayal puts self-preservation above justice or decency. This white betrayal is comfortable. White people know when they have betrayed us. They know the times when they have opened their mouths to object, to speak up, and then swallow their words." That's powerful. Mm. And yet we witnessed that so many times.
You know, even in friendships that you have, after the Queen died, I was having lunch with a dear, dear friend of mine. And we share so much. We share a love of old things and old books and music. And there are so many things that we share. And he was telling me how he cried when the Queen died. And I felt something just break between us. I looked at him and I thought, how? How can you, knowing what's happened to my people? Those two things didn't sit together. The tears for a white monarch in a land of so much suffering for our own people. Those little betrayals, those times when you realise that even those we feel close to are not us, Anne. They don't know the view from the other side of history that we know. I know that there are people who overhear a racist comment or a joke who at times in their lives should have spoken up and didn't, and know that we don't have that option, that we confront that every single day, that even daring to speak or to write invites racial abuse that I get and I'm told online. I don't go there because it's a cesspit and I'd never want to put myself into that world. But my parents get abused because I dare to say something or speak something. And where are people standing with us? When the Queen died, I wondered, where are my colleagues standing with me when you choose to wear a black suit to mourn the Queen? Of course, I respect that her death means something to people. I respect those for whom those traditions mean something. But they don't sit with the experience and the history of my own people. And in this country, to shed those tears, I would wonder, where are the tears for us? So I confront all those things all the time, but Anne, I try to come back always to my ancestors and my people and what they would ask of me. The Indiamara that I was raised in that I must show to others. And you talked before about the forsaken and the suffering. There was a little church on the mission that I was raised on and my uncle was the pastor in, and all of us would gather there each Sunday. And this was a different church to the churches that many of you may go to or the places of worship. This was a black place. You know, this was a place of the forsaken, of prayers to a silent God who doesn't end your suffering. But we find something in ourselves anyway, a faith within ourselves and a love within ourselves to sustain us. And I often go back there at those times, times of betrayal or sadness. I go back there and I try to draw on that, to put myself back there as a little 5 or 6-year-old boy, around, surrounded by my people who would have had every reason for vengeance or hatred in their hearts, and raised me with a love. And I go back there and I try to draw on that, to write those things, to call these things out, but not to divide us or put something between us, but to seek to put the love that my people put in me into others.
That's something I found reading your book, how vulnerable you made yourself. Mm. And you shared a side of yourself that I think few people would have insight to, and that's your faith.
Mm.
And your spirituality, but your pride about your ancestry, and your Christian upbringing, and your family influence on their theology.
Yeah, and it is theology, and you'd know this, Anne, from your work, and you know, I've studied black liberation theology around the world. I used to look to the likes of Martin Luther King Jr. and others who inspired us with that righteous call for justice. You know, and it can be a paradox sometimes. You look at this and you think, isn't Christianity the religion of the conqueror? Mm. It's so tied to the idea of whiteness. King Charles tonight will be blessed with holy oil, like he's a gift from God.
Yes.
Where is the brown-skinned man of sorrows?
He's blessed.
Nailed to a cross, crucified by empire in an occupied land. Where is he in the blessing of a white British king with holy oil? I know where that suffering Jesus was. He was with my people in that little church on the mission. The Jesus who talked about bringing a sword to slay injustice. I don't come to bring peace, I come to bring a sword. The person who said, what is done to the least of thee is done to me. That's the person we took refuge in. That Jesus was not a white Jesus with blonde hair and blue eyes. This was an ancestor. My uncle used to always say to me, I am a Wiradjuri Christian, not white Christendom, not a religion of empire, not the divine right of kings. We had no problem understanding the words of Christ, the words of God, especially the Old Testament. We were Old Testament people. The book of Job, the book of endless suffering, they spoke to us. We had no problem understanding that. We say to people, white people didn't bring God to this land, didn't come in the first fleet. We walked with God every single day. I can't be a Wiradjuri person and ask myself, does God exist? I walk through God's cathedral every day when I'm on my country, under a tree, under the stars, by the river, in the touch of my people. That is real. I do ask, where are you, God? I do ask, how do you allow the ongoing suffering of my people? I struggle with that every single day. But we had no problem finding ourselves in the idea of divine spirit. That was very, very powerful to me. And I think over the past year, even more so, I've returned to that to seek solace. My father is aging and not well, and we're spending a lot of time with him, this giant of a man who suffered and got the wounds on his body of a land that could be so brutal to our people and gave back a gift of love of our language. And in caring for him and feeling Dad's vulnerability, it opens me to my own vulnerability. And it is a vulnerable place. You know, when I finished writing that book, I was a bit sort of scared in a way. You know, I sort of felt, I said to my wife, I was at Reading's bookstore this morning and the entire front window was this book. And she's in Taiwan at the moment. And I sent a text to her and I said, I'm really unnerved by this. I feel a bit exposed by this. There's a lot of vulnerability in this, stuff that I'd rather close the door on. But when you sit down to write, it demands honesty. Anything less is to fail my ancestors, is to fail who I am. But it's a scary place to go when you do that. And I felt empty after finishing the book. I felt depleted, but I also felt nourished by the river and our people and the love of our people. So it's a very, very vulnerable place to take us to open yourself to those things and to seek to share those things with people.
I think by you opening yourself and sharing Aboriginal theology or an insight into our faith, I hope encourages people to maybe walk with us on that journey and discover what it means to belong to this land and what it means to witness the wonders of creation that the Creator has given to us and bestowed upon us.
And I'll tell you something else too, Anne. I've seen this all around the world. I spent a lot of time reporting war, Iraq, Afghanistan, in Pakistan, throughout different parts of Africa, and the terrible things that you see. Whenever I reported, I always felt as if in the eyes of people suffering, I saw the eyes of my own people looking back at me. And in the midst of the worst suffering, I would see these extraordinary acts of love, extraordinary, that would sustain people. And that was the even bigger than what we call the human spirit. There was something working through them that was so unbelievably powerful. But I also had to confront in this book, and I try to be very honest and vulnerable about this, is that my own betrayals and failings, you know, in my own life and my own work, I get very close to whiteness. I can be much more acceptable to white people than even other people in my own family. And I know the lure of that, and I'm alert to the temptation of that, and that sometimes I can lose myself in that. And in that, there are betrayals of my own people. And I have to look to myself in that and to challenge myself about that as well. If I'm not standing on the right side with my people and with love and with history, if I'm tempted to these things around us, I lose myself. So I'm trying to get right with that. And that's another part of the vulnerability of the book that was confronting.
I really took on board the seduction of whiteness because it surrounds us and we function in this world of whiteness, and it is
proximity.
And it is a process of reminding oneself as to why we're here, where we are, and to not be seduced because it demands a lot. You know?
And we also know how easily you will still be rejected.
Oh yeah,
and how that rejection can hurt. And I've felt that at different times of my own life that proximity to whiteness can lend us can make us more acceptable, or as if we are tamed in some way. You know, I think about Barack Obama and the price of the presidency. the price of the presidency was to stop, in a way, to be a less threatening presence, to be a comforting presence. That was part of the deal, to bring comfort to a country that we know is so deeply racially riven. And in his time in office, Black Lives Matter appears as a movement, but people continue to die on their streets while the black person is in the White House. And that proximity can demand so much of us, ask so much of us, offer us so much, but lose so much as well. So I think we need to be very alert to that. And then, of course, there are moments when you are confronted with that. And I think I talk about in the book last year, I think it was, I was standing outside the back of the ABC in Sydney and I was recording something and my cameraman was there. He happened to be a Chinese person, my cameraman. And I saw a man and his girlfriend walking towards me, young guy. And, you know, Anne, we get a vibe. And I just had an uneasy feeling. And as he got close to me, he yelled loudly the N-word. And I know that shouldn't define me. I know I should say that is just, you know, who is he? I should be able to look past that. I know that I passed hundreds of people in the street that day and most people smiled at me. But that word lands with such a power. It lands with such a history. It took my breath away. And I thought, so for all of that, for being on television, for being watched by people and for being close to whiteness, someone can say that to you. And we don't know where or when that's going to come. And that night when I was driving home, I started to cry because that hit me so deeply. And those words land with the full weight of that history, and that proximity to whiteness also makes us very vulnerable to it.
Exactly. I'm just going to share one last quote as I open up for Q&A, because I think this is describes your vulnerability to a T. I pity those who use faith to mask their bigotry, those who scour scriptures looking for ways to judge others. I will defend my faith on the mountain of grace, love, forgiveness, humility, and kindness that I get on bended knee to ask for every day. They're powerful words.
Thank you.
I'm going to open it up to the audience for Q&A. Now, if the house lights could be turned up a little so I can see people and see their hands. I can see someone right up the back.
Is the microphone just roving around?
Yes, right up the back.
It would be right up the back, you see. Yeah. Make you run.
You'll get fit today.
I can see you all now. The lovely audience
right
you
up
are.
There.
Beautiful. There's a gentleman at the front here with his hand up too.
Yes,
if there's another microphone.
I see
one
there. Yeah. Is there another mic?
Hello.
You come down here.
Hi, Stan.
Oh,
thank
yeah.
you for your talk.
Booming
right
now.
Up the back
yeah.
here. I just have a question for you. It may be a little bit tricky to answer. I'm as the mother of three girls from the Kuma Nation, which is southwest Queensland, and as an ally. I'm just wondering what advice you can give to me and other allies should the outcome of the referendum this year be not the outcome we all hope for, and it's a negative response.
Well, we live in a world with a negative response right now. We are a nation, the only Commonwealth nation never to have signed treaties with First Nations people, that our place on our own land is still not fully recognised. In many ways, and again, it comes back to this thing that I am not a political being. When I get close to politics, I do feel diminished. It is not in my soul. I look for poetry rather than politics. There's a beautiful phrase that hangs over the Scottish Parliament written by Andrew Fraser, who was a politician and a poet. And it says, if I could write all the songs, I would not care who wrote the laws. Laws are things of impermanence, but songs are things of eternity. Poetry speaks to eternity. I picked up an old book of Ovid the other day, the poems of exile, and they can still speak to me today. So my roundabout way of answering your question is to say, regardless of what happens, and people in this room may vote differently, I don't know. I'm not in the business of going around and trying to win political campaigns. I'm glad others can do that. It's not in my soul. But regardless of what happens, we're going to wake up a yes or a no to the same country where the rivers flow the same way. The damage that we have done to our earth, the damage that we have done to ourselves, the distance between us, and we will still reach for the song of the country that poets and writers and artists have sought to grapple with, white and black, forever. Whether it's Patrick White's Tree of Man or a Drysdale painting of a lone person looking out into the landscape, whether it's the disappearing girls of Picnic at Hanging Rock, whether it's the wondrous worlds that Alexis Wright brings to life in her novels, whether it's an Archie Roach song. The things of the soul are what I'm interested in. And I think for your children as well, that you share blood with us, that in that sharing you find a song of the soul of a country that can speak powerfully to us. And that's the work that will have to be done. And if the voice succeeds, that'll have to go to work doing the things of politics. But the Uluru Statement will still stand there as something that speaks to the soul. And the work that I'm interested in is the work of the soul that happens the day after, regardless of the result, to make that result mean something and to make this country mean something for your children and us. Yes, sir.
Dan, I wanted to pick up that theme you introduced at the very beginning of whiteness, the myth of whiteness, because it resonates a book I've been reading again, which is Sapiens, which talks about the myths.
Yuval Noah Harari's book.
Right. Yeah. And I guess what I'm grappling with, I'm interested in your thought as to how we see our way out of this, because we all need myths. They establish the structure of our cultures. And yet, people needed the myth in many cases of the world to believe that black people were inferior, not just culturally, but physically and mentally, and they did medical tests to prove that they were inferior. Men used to have to believe that women were inferior. We needed it because we'd created this culture that did those things. So when you look at the fundamental myth here, we need myths, but we also need to deal with the consequences of the way these myths create these things which are fundamentally wrong and so bad. Where do you see, from what you've been looking at, the glimmer of how we might start to maintain the important myths that maintain our cultures, or the Australian culture, whatever that means, and a way forward so we could deal with these myths which are just creating so much pain?
You know, I think myths, I'm glad you talked about myths, because myth is the right word. I remember Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist, who wrote The Hero of a Thousand Faces. And he had this beautiful phrase. He said, myths are transparent to the transcendent. Isn't that beautiful? Myths are transparent to the transcendent. They reveal something eternal in us. When I was a young boy, I was a voracious reader, and my mother said, you know, born so old. And I didn't go to school very much because we moved around a lot. I changed schools about 14 times before I was even into high school because we were an itinerant, homeless family moving from town to town and Dad looking for work wherever he could find it. But Mum always got books from secondhand stores and anything, pick up anything. And I remember once for my birthday, she got me a second-hand book of Greek myths. And I became fascinated by Greek mythology because it was transparent to the transcendent. The story of Narcissus that looks at him at his own reflection. Isn't that whiteness that falls in love with its own reflection? That spurns the love of Echo because he's so in love with himself? I think myth is the right word, but myths reveal, and the myth of whiteness that we have taken as real, we need to look at what that reveals about us. You accurately said, the myths reveal our desire for power, men over women, white over black, whatever that may be. But let's be honest about what it reveals, because that's why myths were written. They were written to reveal. And I think something is being, when the Queen died, it revealed something to me about myself as well as my country. But I think the world that we are living in reveals something to us. The old tropes, the old orthodoxies, even what we call the global rules-based order, which emerges out of empire and colonization and genocide, that is a power-based order, is being disrupted. The rise of China, which is disrupting politics and challenging it in so many ways, disrupting economies. The fact that by 2050, only one Western country, the United States, is predicted to be in the top 10 economies of the world. Power is shifting. That Caucasian people, if we even want to define people in terms of race, represent fewer than 10% of the world's population. And yet the world has been defined in that image. I think you're right to identify myth. But rather than look to create new myths of power, look to what the old myths reveal and what they were always seeking to tell us about ourselves and to act on what that reveals.
This will be the last question.
Thank you so much.
Where are you?
I wondered if moving...
Oh, there you are. I'm looking back here.
I wondered if in relation to myth, the role of nostalgia, and if nostalgia gets in the way of that movement from remorse into contrition.
Yes.
Because Professor Patel Gray, you mentioned about, you quoted, no redemption without atonement, and that made me immediately think of remorse, contrition, as an underpinning thing. But does nostalgia get in the way?
Have you been reading my mail? Nostalgia. I wrote an article about nostalgia for the ABC not long ago. And it was about the toxicity of nostalgia, the militant nostalgia, often tied to an idea of historical catastrophe. We hear it in the language of the rise of the political right, the idea that we'll be replaced, the hankering for a golden age. What was Donald Trump if it wasn't the politics of nostalgia? I will make America great again. What is Brexit if it isn't about recovering some Churchillian lost glory? Why does Viktor Orban put the barbed wire on the borders of Hungary to keep people out? Why is Vladimir Putin waging his war in Ukraine? Because he's trying to avenge the great catastrophe of the 20th century, as he described it, in the fall of the Soviet Empire. When I was in China, Xi Jinping talked constantly of the 100 years of humiliation to eat bitterness that's built into the soul of the modern political Chinese identity. And I grapple with that all the way through the book because I know that the lure of that song, because the wounds are real, the resentment is real, and how easily we can trigger that and weaponize that. When I reported the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, when I sat with militants who would talk about restoring a glory, fighting old wars, I think we need to be very alert to the militant toxicity of nostalgia when it is tied to identity and emerges out of grievance. I have a grievance. I have a wound. I know the dangers that can come from this that wound. But what do I look to? And this is what I've had to challenge myself, because I know that those things are in me too. Those impulses are in me. But all I have to do is go home and sit on my country. What do I sit with my parents? All I have to do is be reminded of Yindyamara, the power of their love of our people and the love of our country, to be able to answer back the lure of the toxicity of that nostalgia. So that's such a brilliant question, because I think the politics of our age are being shaped and fought over between those who want to hold on to a militant, romanticized idea of some golden past that perhaps never even existed, and weaponize that to hold us back from the future that we may all share together.
Thank you, Stan. I would like to invite a representative from Maurice Blackburn, the sponsor for this session, to come up, please, and say a few words. Felicity.
Thanks, Stan and Anne. Good afternoon. I'm grateful for the warm welcome to country which began our festival, and I freely join in the humble acknowledgements of country which have marked the festival's conversations so far. My name is Felicity Pantelidis, and I'm from Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. We are proud to sponsor the Melbourne Writers Festival and to support the Yes campaign. Central to our purpose at Maurice Blackburn is that the law is there to serve everyone. And for many years, we have worked alongside Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people for that principle. Thank you, Stan and Anne, for your conversation. It has been a privilege today to hear your voices, and we have learnt so much. And we all have so much to do together this year. Thanks.
Can I please thank Anne? She has been such an inspiration to me. Please read the things Anne writes. The justice and the righteousness and the love that comes from Anne's work. And Anne is one of those people who has helped to hold me to the world and hold me to my people and the love that our people have to offer, all of us in this room. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Stan. Thank you. I highly recommend this book, and it is for sale just out front, and Stan will be out there to sign them for you. Thank you so much for coming. I hope you enjoyed this session with us, and that you found a lot of answers to many questions that you may have come with. God bless. Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.